venue is Monkey Puzzle. It is sponsored by the Church Times, and Greenbelt is very appreciative of that. And I have a friend of mine working in the tent and in the hospital, and yesterday they had lots of dehydrated people and sunburn, particularly children. So, with apologies to the Australians, slip, slap, slop throughout today because it's going to be hotter today. So, I think we're ready to start. Okay, good.
Thanks a lot.
Morning, everyone. I'm Garth Hewitt. Delighted to be introducing Naeem today. And just one thing before I do that, to say there is a petition going round, which will pass your way, done by the Israeli Campaign Against Home Demolitions, and it's UK, and they're asking for the British government to do more about settlements and occupation. So if that comes your way and you would like to sign it, please do, and then at the end just make sure it comes up to the front. It relates to things that will be talked about this morning. Many of you, and probably most, if not all of you, know Naeem by now. Naeem Atik is the director of Sabeel Liberation Ecumenical Centre in Jerusalem. It's a hugely significant place, and Naeem's own ministry has been hugely significant as they've tried to grapple with what you do with your own faith when the Bible is used as an instrument of oppression, and how you journey forward in that situation. And so Naeem has been a very significant thinker in liberation theology, to take it beyond just the Exodus model and to see what it might mean as a liberating model. He is a Palestinian. He's also an Israeli citizen, and combines these things which are so important at the moment on the journey to peace. So I'm delighted to introduce you, because I do remember the first time we met, I think it was about 89, and I went in and talked to you about theology and things, and when I came out, I said to the friend who was an Amos Trust trustee that was with me, I've been converted. And, oh, he said, at last. So Naeem has played an important part in my life, and today he's talking on the subject of who's Jerusalem. Let's welcome Naeem Atik.
Thank you very much, Garth. And thank you all for being here today. By your presence, I understand that the whole question of Jerusalem is very, very important to you. And I want to be sure that we are going to have a good time for discussion, because I felt bad yesterday that we had very little time. And so I'm going to forget most of my notes. Eventually, these lectures I will be publishing, and you can maybe read the greater details. So what I'm going to do is to give you the crux of the message that is very biblical, and then I hope we will have good time for discussion. Now, the Bible, as you know, is a big book. You can prove anything if you choose your text. And this is what we've done throughout history. We've supported slavery by choosing certain texts, polygamy. We silenced women by the Bible. We justified wars by the Bible. We justify ethnic cleansing by the Bible, and so on and on. And today, some people are justifying an exclusive claim for Israel by the Bible, and I'm going to show you that. But I don't believe that the message of the Bible is about exclusive claims, but about inclusive claims. And although, ultimately, I believe that the whole question of Jerusalem must be solved in accordance with international law, United Nations resolutions, but the Bible can inspire us towards an inclusive solution. So, without more introductions about this, I want to look at four texts with you. Two texts from the Old Testament, and two texts from the New Testament, say a few words about them, and then open it up for discussion. So I want to put on the screen the first text, and because not all of you can really see the screen, I'm going to ask someone to read it for you. Please listen carefully. And this is, let's read the text.
Nehemiah 2:19-20. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they mocked and ridiculed us, saying, "What is this that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" Then I replied to them, "The God of heaven is the one who will give us success, and we, his servants, are going to start building. But you have no share or claim or historic right in Jerusalem."
It's an amazing text coming from Nehemiah. After the exile, the Persians, when they took over from the Babylonians, defeated Babylon, they sent Nehemiah as a governor of Judea to administer the civil affairs. And later on, they sent a priest by the name of Ezra to Jerusalem to administer the religious side of things there. And they started to build the walls of Jerusalem, Ezra, Nehemiah. And then these people, they're named there. There is Sanballat, Horonite, an Ammonite official, and interestingly, Jassim, the Arab. They come to these Jews in Jerusalem and they say, "Look, what's happening here? You're building. Is this a rebellion against the king of Persia? What are you really doing?" And Nehemiah says to him, "The God of heaven is the one who will give us success. We are his servants. We are going to start building. But you have no share or claim or historic right in Jerusalem." This is a very exclusive text where people come and say, "Jerusalem only belongs to us." And if you really look at the words in Nehemiah, you see that today the Israeli government and Zionist, Jewish Zionist, and Christian Zionist, they use the same terminology. That is, the Palestinians have no claim, historic claim. They have no historic right, and they cannot share Jerusalem. It's coming out using a text from the Bible to exclude the Palestinians totally out. If you look at Ezra in another place, chapter 4, before this happened, or after this happened, there was another incident where, you know, Ezra was trying to build a temple. And some people come and say, "Let us help you build the temple. We also believe in God. We want to help you." And Ezra says, and Zerubbabel says, no, you cannot build. This is our God. You cannot really help us with this." Again, a very exclusive text that pretends or that claims that God is only the God of a few people rather than the God of all. This is a big problem today, because what we are experiencing back home is this exclusivity. And this exclusivity will never, mark my word, will never bring us peace. Because only a few segments of the population that says Jerusalem belongs to us, it doesn't belong to you. Okay, we're going to go to the second passage.
Psalm 87. On the holy mount stands the city he founded. The Lord loves the gates of Zion more than all the dwellings of Jacob. Glorious things are spoken of you, O city of God. Among those who know me, I mention Rahab and Babylon, Philistia too, and Tyre with Ethiopia. This one was born there, they say. And of Zion it shall be said, this one and that one were born in it, for the Most High himself will establish it. The Lord records as he registers the peoples. This one was born there. Singers and dancers alike say, all my springs are in you.
This is an amazing text. It is theologically so progressive, so advanced, that some scholars did not really know what to do with it. They couldn't believe that a poet, Jewish poet, can come up with a psalm, with a poem, religious poem like this, and when, you know, you cannot really understand this. I couldn't understand it without the help of commentary. You read it in the Psalms, and it's very difficult. But with the help of a good commentary, it begins to reveal the depth of what I would call Palestinian liberation theologian who wrote this poem, you know, and presented it in those days. It must have been written, as scholars tell us, after the exile. So there is a poet, religious poet, who's coming out with this psalm and reflecting on Jerusalem. It is usually called a hymn of Zion. But please, again, very, very quickly, I want to point out the depth of the message of this psalm. It really reveals God, who lives in Jerusalem, according to the psalm. This is the city of God. And then God says, among those who know me are Rahab. Rahab is a mythological beast that refers to Egypt. So among those who know me, God says, are the Egyptians. The Egyptians, historically speaking, have been always enemies, most of the time, enemies of the Jews or the Israelites. God says, the ones who know me include Egyptians. It includes Babylon. Babylon destroyed Jerusalem and Judah. But God says, the ones who know me are also the Babylonians. Look at this advanced theology. Says Philistia, the Philistines, enemies of Israel and Judah. But God claims that the Philistines are also God's people. Tyre. Tyre was a commercial center in Phoenicia, in the north, and Ethiopia. I mean, it is unbelievable. This poet that sees that God is standing beside the gate of Jerusalem, and he are registering people who are coming in. Of Zion it shall be said, this one and that one were born in it. You need to imagine it. God standing at the gate and seeing these people who come to worship, and God saying, oh, this Egyptian, he was born in Jerusalem. This Ethiopian, he was born in Jerusalem. This Babylonian, all these people, by the virtue of knowing God, worshiping God, they all belong to Jerusalem. It's a very inclusive text. Earth-shattering, theologically advanced, singers and dancers alike, all my springs are in you. It's a wonderful, inclusive, embracing poem. I tell you, we can stop here, as far as I'm concerned. Because you have the exclusive text that is excluding others, and this inclusive text that brings all the enemies, the Babylonians and the Egyptians and the Philistines and everybody else. It brings them and says, all of them belong to Jerusalem. They're born in Jerusalem. Those who come to worship from outside and those who are living there. Isn't that a wonderful thing? This is, in my opinion, can be a paradigm for the resolution of the conflict today, because it brings all of us, Palestinians, Israelis, Jews, Arabs, Americans, British, everywhere. We all spiritually belong to Jerusalem and are born there. Let's look at the third text.
John 4, verse 20. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you say that the place where people must worship is in Jerusalem. Jesus said to her, Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father seeks such as these to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth.
Now, once you get to the New Testament, it takes you beyond geography. Jerusalem is not really that important. Gerizim is not important because this Samaritan woman, you know, is engaging Jesus. Jesus engaging the Samaritan woman in this discussion. And, you know the story. But let me say, you know, the Samaritan says she was embarrassed because he was really becoming a little bit personal. And she says, where should we worship, you know? On this mountain for the Samaritans or in Jerusalem for Jews? Which is the right place to worship? And Jesus says, not here nor there. God is spirit. If you want to worship God, you need to worship God in spirit and in truth. You know, I recently saw the Kingdom of Heaven movie, and towards the end of the movie, Balian asks, what is Jerusalem worth? Saladin says, nothing. And then Saladin begins to walk away and then looks back and says, everything. This is the dynamic of Jerusalem. For some of us believers, I live in Jerusalem. I've lived in Jerusalem for the last 20 years. But for me, as a believer, Jerusalem is not that really important. I can worship God anywhere. The Holy Land is not really that special. This is Holy Land. It's part of God's world. Every part of God's world which God made, Christ sanctified through the incarnation. We are living in a world that is sacramental because God has honored this world through the incarnation. And you know, for the last 300 years, Jerusalem was not really that important. In fact, the bishop was in Caesarea. Eusebius, wonderful, great scholar, bishop in Caesarea. He was not emphasizing the importance of the holy places. He was emphasizing the redemption, what Christ has done on the cross for all people. And then comes Cyril of Jerusalem, 4th century, you know, after Constantine. And then we begin to think about the Holy Land, the holy places where we go. And so we began to change our theology of the holy places. And so we live today between Jerusalem as a place where we all go because we want to remember what Christ has done for us. But also we live, again, in the fact that we can live without Jerusalem. Jesus takes us beyond geography and says, if you want to worship God, you can worship God in spirit and in truth. Let's look at the last.
Revelation 21. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride and adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, see, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them as their God, and they will be his peoples. And God himself will be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. For the first things have passed away. And the one who was seated on the throne said, see, I am making all things new. Also he said, write this, for these words are trustworthy and true.
In the book of Revelation, John, the author, saw the city of Rome as an embodiment of Babylon, the capital of the Babylonian Empire, representing evil. Evil. The theological significance of Babylon, however, extends far beyond the historical capital of the Roman Empire. When political powers become empire, they can become Babylon. Babylon exists wherever socio-political power coalesces into an entity that stands against the worship of God alone. New Jerusalem is found wherever the human community, wherever the church rejects the lies and violence of empire and places God at the center of its shared life. John saw the real competition is between Babylon, Rome, and New Jerusalem, between the city of the beast and the city of the lamb, between the dragon's empire and the empire of the faithful followers of Jesus Christ. And so John says, come out of Babylon. Leave it. Leave empire and live in New Jerusalem. This call to come out served as both encouragement and warning to the churches. Those who are faithfully resisting Rome were encouraged to continue in their resistance. And those who were colluding with empire were warned that the time to leave was now. It is a call to discern the true character of where they were and how to distance themselves from the imperial seduction of their time and place. They must leave Babylon and live in New Jerusalem. The latter, New Jerusalem, is found wherever the community of faith resists the ways of empire and places God at the center of its life. These are the true residents of New Jerusalem. This is the picture that I really wanted to leave with you today. These four texts, the first two, I believe, can challenge us to look for a solution, rejecting the exclusive claim and looking for an inclusive claim as we look at Psalm 87. But also, we need to go beyond geography and begin to really build a new Jerusalem right here, a community of faith that rejects empire and clings and have God at the center of its life. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Naeem. And that gives us plenty of time for questions. So Gavin is going to run around with the roving mic. I think, just bear in mind, keep your questions nice and cryptic so we can get in plenty of them. And if you go on too long, I'll wind you up. But if you can put hands up so we can start to see. We'll start at the front, but also just give me a good show of who wants to ask questions. And then Gavin also can glance around so we know where to go. Okay, we'll look again. It goes right to that country singer at the back there. Okay. Let's start down here.
Yes, if I can ask a very sort of up-to-date and personal question. You are an Israeli citizen, you're a Palestinian Christian. How included do you feel, and do you feel you have the same rights as, for example, Jewish citizens of Israel? If you could give us some even sort of legal differences that do exist in Jerusalem today.
Yeah, I do not feel included in the way Israel, the government of Israel, is building Jerusalem. Since 1967, the policy of the government of Israel is to Judaize Jerusalem. That is, make Jerusalem exclusively Jewish. So there have been all kinds of policies throughout the last 38 years to really do everything that Israel can to leave Palestinians out. So, for example, Israel doesn't want the Palestinian population of Jerusalem, which is the majority at one point, to be large. And so they've specified that there cannot be more than 26 or 27% Arabs or Palestinians in Jerusalem. So this means excluding, it means forcing people to leave. Another way that Israel has done is that giving unlimited funding to religious fanatic Jewish groups that by hook or crook are taking Palestinian areas from East Jerusalem and making them Jewish. Sometimes bribing people, sometimes paying large amounts of money for this, sometimes falsifying documents. All of these things, I am telling you, are documented. So I'm not just saying this. Another way is that Jerusalem is really cut off from most of the Palestinian Muslims and Christians. During holy days, neither Muslims nor Christians can come into Jerusalem if they don't have the right permit. And so it's very interesting, you know, when I talk about Psalm 87, you know, where even the enemies outside were welcomed, according to this wonderful psalm. And yet Jerusalem today, you know, is a very exclusive place, cut off for most of its people. People cannot go in and worship God in the Church of the Resurrection, what people would call the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They cannot come in because they are living in the West Bank and they don't have permits. Muslims cannot come to the Dome of the Rock or the Al-Aqsa Mosque to really worship God. So today, Jerusalem is a very exclusive place. It is a place that most of our people, including myself, we cannot feel at home because everywhere you look, you see the Judaization of the place rather than opening it up, embracing the other rather than excluding the other.
You are a Palestinian Christian. Can you explain for us why it's important that the Christians remain there if Christians can worship God anywhere?
It's our homeland. It's our home place. Home is significant. Home is something precious. We all feel attached to our homes. to our home place. We moved from one area to another. I lived, most of my ministry was in Galilee. But for the last 20 years, it's been in Jerusalem. It's home. And so Christians would like to be there and live in their home. But more than that, many of our people, you know, most of the Christians in back home are Orthodox and Catholic. The Protestants are very, very few there. And for the Catholics and for the Orthodox, maybe more than most Protestants, but including some Protestants, they are attached to holy places, whether we like it or not. It's the holy land. It is the holy place. Jerusalem is where Christ was crucified, where Christ was resurrected, where the church, by the power of the Holy Spirit, emerged. And so they want to be there. It is the land where Jesus lived. So that's they're attached to it. Unfortunately, today we are a very small community. Most of the Christians have immigrated and have left. But still, is for those of us who want to stay, I don't want to leave. This is my home. I want to be there, and I want to feel like everybody else. I want to live there on an equal basis. I want a democracy that guarantees my rights and my responsibilities like everybody else. I don't want to be living under domination by Israeli occupation. I want a democracy that gives liberation and freedom to all the people so that I can live in my home, and the Muslim can live there, and the Jew can live there. We can. Psalm 87. Don't forget Psalm 87, please.
I've been an evangelical Christian for many years, and I guess have been of the opinion that Israel was given to the Jews from Old Testament studies and so on. And that's certainly a very prevalent viewpoint amongst evangelical Christians. About a year or two ago, because I work with refugees, I started to study the Old Testament in terms of what it says about refuge and what is said in the law about foreigners. And it seems to me that, in fact, if Israel actually was keeping the Old Testament law, then it would be an inclusive country, because foreigners were granted, if they wanted to assimilate, they would be granted full rights. And the second thing, I guess, as a sort of corollary to that, is that I read last year Light Force by Brother Andrew, which I found very moving, because he's actually bringing together Messianic Jews and Palestinian Christians to meet and find out what the other side is thinking. I wonder if you could comment on that and his work.
Well, I would like to make a comment on the first part, actually, of what you said, because I think it's very important, again, in the spirit of what I've been saying in the last couple of days and today. In the Bible, you can come up with a very exclusive theology. And I tell you, many Christians have done precisely that. Most of our Christians, but I know that fundamentalists, I know that Christian Zionists have come up with a very exclusive theology of the land. But I believe that although they claim that they know the scriptures, I believe that most of these people have not really dug deep enough into the scripture. Because although there are those passages that are exclusive, but you know, once you get after the exile, and you know, this is, I tried in at least the last 2 days to bring out from the Old Testament itself the movement towards inclusivity. There is no shadow of a doubt. I mean, when you look at Ezekiel, after the exile, is critiquing the Genesis accounts, in my opinion. Because it's only in Genesis, in the Torah part, the first five books, that you have this exclusive theology that basically says, what do you do with the people of the land according to the Torah? Or you do two things, and it amazes us today. Only two things with the people of the land, according to the Torah. You expel them, or you eliminate them. you kill them. That's it. According to the Torah. Now, Ezekiel comes after the exile and sees that the situation in Palestine has changed. Not only Jews are living there, and you know, there were never times, never, historically, that Jews were living alone on the land. Never. Study it. But Ezekiel says, now there are more people who are not Jewish living on the land. So what is God saying? So Ezekiel, end of chapter 47, says, you know, now, folks, you're coming back from the exile. You see all the people there, here, living. There are Samaritans, there are the Arabs, Geshem. You know, you find the Arabs are already there. I mean, other people are there. What does God say to you? And Ezekiel says, God tells you, you got to live with all the people of the land and share the same inheritance. Now, he calls them aliens. I'm not an alien. I belong there. But even if they consider me alien, God says in the voice of, or in the words of Ezekiel, all the people of the land after the exile, whether they're Jewish or not Jewish, they all belong to the land and they must have the same inheritance. So you have a choice, which is in the spirit of the Bible. Is it the exclusive Genesis or is it the inclusive Ezekiel in that sense, in this passage? So I tell you, my challenge to fundamentalist Christians, my challenge to Christian Zionists is that don't accept a superficial reading of the scriptures. Move on, because it will lead you to an inclusive Christ, inclusive God, inclusive theology of land, inclusive theology of the people of God. This is exactly the message of Jonah. Jonah, for me, the story of Jonah, is the climax, the theological climax of the whole Old Testament. When you dig deep and study the story of Jonah, it's not about a big fish. It is the story about a God who's not limited to Israel, is concerned about Assyria, the staunchest of all enemies of Israel, and tell Jonah, go to Assyria, because I care about those people. So it's a story about a God who embraces all humanity, not only one segment of it. And it reflects on the theology of God, the theology of the people of God, and the theology of God is not only interested or limited to the Holy Land, but other lands. So that's the Bible that I know. And this is the Bible that I read. And this is the critique within the scripture for anything that is exclusive. And we need to critique it and lift up always the inclusive message of Christ.
Thank you very much, Naim. Can I just make a comment about the book Light Force? Because I thought that was a very interesting reference. And the people that Brother Andrew works with are really Bethlehem Bible College and the organization Musalaha, who are working with Messianic Christians and with Palestinian Christians. And if you want to know more about that at the Rediscovering Palestine stand, we can tell you about it, or we can put you in touch with that. So contact me about that. The book is fascinating because of his links with Hamas. And the fact that it's now very important history, because the people that he's spoken to, like Rantisi, like Sheikh Yassin, have been assassinated by the Israeli Defense Force, and you see a completely different side. And this very, I think you would accept, very simple, straightforward Christian has gone to talk to them and found that he could make alliances, and in some ways they could talk the same language. So it was very important.
I've been very moved and challenged over these 2 days by what you've said. Moved by an experience of living that I have to confess I can't begin to imagine. and challenged in my comfortable middle class rural existence in part of England as to what I can do as a Christian. What can I do?
Thank you. I would say, regarding our situation back home, the challenge is that our brothers and sisters here, first of all, need to know. If they don't know enough, they need to know. So please accept the challenge. If you can come and visit, this is the best. It's a conversion experience. I'll put a plug for he brings groups. Come with him. Give me a share of the profit. Sabil organizes 2 trips. There are other organizations that are doing it. Come and see. We used to send people to Gaza. Conversion experience. We send them to Hebron. It's a conversion experience. You need to come and see. If you cannot come, there are resources available here in this country. You really need. Begin by personal education. Then educate others. And hopefully, people will move from education to advocacy. We need people to work on the British government. You know, many of the problems that started there, unfortunately, were instigated by the British government. And the British government has a responsibility to bring about a just peace in Palestine. And I believe that our people here need to continue with advocacy, you know. And this is, I think, is very, very important. And then I would say, talk to your neighbors who are Christian Zionist. If you cannot talk to them, find the right people who can really talk to them. But we really need to, in a very kind way, help them to look at the deeper message of the Bible. These are just pointers, but I think, you know, there are resources here in Greenbelt here at the Emporium, you know, where you can also use. But next year, for example, Sabil will have its 6th international conference, and our focus is going to be on the forgotten faithful about Palestinian Christianity. If you can come, look for the, you know, the publicity for it. It will take place towards the end of October of 2006. We'd love to see you with us.
I'd like to say thank you, first of all, to you for a wonderful sort of theological and spiritual appraisal of the situation of Jerusalem today. But you mentioned at the beginning that this was a problem which had to be solved in international law. I wonder how you, as a Palestinian living in Israel, see a physical resolution of the Jerusalem question.
Thank you very much. And I'm very glad that the question has been asked, because although we get inspiration from the Bible, ultimately it is we need to base the solution on international law. This means that what we are promoting, Sabil is promoting, many of us are promoting, is a two-state solution according international law. Today, United Nations resolutions is that as there is a state of Israel, there must be a state of Palestine. Very succinctly put. What do you do with Jerusalem? Jerusalem must be shared. In our vision for Jerusalem, that it is easy. I mean, there is a will, there is a way. And the way is that West Jerusalem can be the capital of the State of Israel. East Jerusalem can be the capital of Palestine. We don't have to have borders. We don't have to have walls separating the two. We can leave the city open, where people can live there, move,
I mean, we did it before. We lived there. There was a Palestine. The city was open. The problem today is domination, when one group dominates the other. And so let's share the city. It can be the capital of two states. And I think we can not only exist, but live and enjoy life together. And there has been creative ideas for the resolution of the whole question back home. So it is not limited only to these. But basically, you know, this is what we are really talking about. Ultimately, some of us believe in 100 years' time, we don't even need the two states. Why can't we be one state? It's a small country, you know. We can live as Jews, as Christians, as Muslims together in a democratic state of Palestine, Israel. Call it what you want. But today, I believe the next step must be the two states with a shared Jerusalem.
Your talks have given us huge signs of hope, especially for biblical hermeneutic. A proper contextual reading certainly is a solution, and I have witnessed it immensely in India from working as a liberation theology background. Now, my question to you is, are there such signs of a hermeneutic reading from the side of Islam, from the side of Judaism, on their own texts? And is there such a kind of a consensus among, say, scholars even, to come together from different traditions towards a kind of a contextual reading as we do in Christianity?
I believe that there are. They're not as maybe as prevalent or as obvious because of the extremist elements in society. On the Jewish side, for example, the best theologians that I mean, this sounds strange. The best theologians that I have come are secular Jews. You know, it's amazing. I have not really been able to partner with many religious Jews, although one of my best friends is Mark Ellis, but he's not an Israeli. He's an American Jew who's religious, and we're very close. Now, there is that kind of a theology that is emerging and has emerged, actually, but, you know, their voices are suppressed by the majority. That is very exclusive. I think the same thing with Muslims, you know. Frankly, the form of Islam that we have is pretty conservative in Palestine. And many times you see that the more progressive Muslims have left the country. But I find some sheikhs, you know, some of the religious leaders that we dialogue with. And Sabil has a program of Christian-Muslim relations. So there is. And obviously Sabil is doing liberation theology on the Christian, in the Christian context. But again, we are very small in many ways, and we are not able really to impact great change. But at the end of the day, we have to be faithful to God. Whatever we can do, we must do out of faithfulness, you know. And I think that's what we are trying to do with our brothers and sisters from the different religions, and educate our own people that also need that kind of a theology. And let me just say, although sometimes things look bleak, but we live in hope. And as Christians, we cannot give in to despair. And so we must keep lifting up, you know, this message. You know, that is the inclusive message of God's love that embraces all people.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Naeem. I mean, I think there summarized the heart of this liberating gospel, which I believe is so important in this situation. That's although you've been running from different event to different event, I think the running has just about stopped now. This is Naeem's last event here, and I believe it's been extremely important to have him here this year. And perhaps we can just show our appreciation once again. Thank you, Naeem. I think that shows how people feel. Just before you rush off, to say there is a conference that Sabeel is doing called What is Truth later this year in November. Details available, I think, as you leave over there. Yes, they're being waved by Sue there. Naeem and also Mark Ellis, the Jewish liberation theologian, will be there. There is a Contemporary Way of the Cross, beautiful document by Sabeel. It's not available, but orders can be taken as you leave over at Rediscovering Palestine. Also, you can get the Cornerstone magazine as you leave. Palestine Solidarity Campaign has a conference in October, Palestine, Israel and the Law. Has a remarkable list of speakers, including Dr. Mustafa Baghouti from Ramallah. Do link up with the Palestine Solidarity Campaign to help that cause forward. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.